Welcome to Frame of Reference, informed, intelligent conversations about the issues and challenges facing everyone in today's world. In-depth interviews with Sauk County's leaders and professionals to help you expand and inform your frame of reference. Brought to you by the Max FM Digital Network. Now here's your host, Raoul Labrèche.
Well, welcome to another edition of Frame of Reference, Sauk County and Beyond. And if you joined us last week, actually for the past couple of weeks, I've been way beyond, which is not too unusual for me. Anyone that knows me personally knows that I am speaking truth, or as we say, I think nowadays, book. So anyways, my guest last week and this week is a young gentleman by the name of Zach Schreier. Zach is an entrepreneur extraordinaire. I think it's referred to as a serial entrepreneur. And we talked about the beginning of that serialization last week on our episode. And this week, you get done with high school, Zach, right? We were talking about how you were in high school, actually in middle school, you had a little contraband operation going there with Japanese sodas or soft drinks. Were they sodas? Actual sodas, right?
20 grams of sugar per unit there.
Yeah. And carbonation and all that good stuff? So,
partly carbonated, I think.
Okay. Well, what kind of flavors were there?
We had a kind of plain, like base standard flavor, kind of like Sprite. And then there was an orange and a raspberry, I think.
Okay. So
a long time ago.
So would those be really good if you wanted to like look at anime? Do you have to drink Japanese soda and watch anime together? Is that socially acceptable?
Yeah, I suppose you could do that. Yeah.
We're going to have an anime and Japanese soda party. So, you get done with school. You went to college. Where'd you end up going to college again?
Went to Williams College. Okay. It's a small liberal arts college out in Northwest Massachusetts.
Okay. Northwest Massachusetts. So you went away from home. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It's the Berkshire.
Okay. So, a small private liberal arts college? Is that pretty?
Yep.
I thought I saw something where it was somehow connected with businesses, or am I thinking of something else altogether, like kind of like the Kellogg School of Design, that kind of thing. Nothing like that?
Yeah, Williams is independent, actually. No affiliations like that.
Okay. So, and I'm assuming did you start out as a philosophy major, or how did that come about?
Yeah, so, in high school, actually, even starting in middle school, I had a sixth grade teacher actually exposed me to philosophy through a book called Sophie's World, I think it was called. And Sophie would interact with a bunch of philosophers and sort of form her beliefs about the world. And okay. So sort of got me started thinking about, I guess in sixth grade, I sort of formulated my own version of the problem of other minds. And I loved sort of teasing classmates with this, like, you can't prove to me that there's anything going on inside your head type of thing.
That's right up there with a tree falls in the forest and no one's around to hear it. Does it really make a noise? You can't prove to me it does, you know? Right. So, yeah, here we go. So,
and then in eighth grade, there was a question about, it was a social studies question about maybe the morality of something like factory farming. And so that sort of made me wonder about morality and where we get morality from. Okay. And then in high school, there was I used to consider myself kind of a hard determinist, even though I didn't have the language for it. But I was sort of convinced that because of physical determinism, something like free will couldn't exist.
Wow, there we go. Nihilism, here I come. So yeah, great. Yeah.
Yeah, the whole thing, moralism, and then also this sort of anti-free will position. And then I sort of figured I knew everything at that point and there was no need to learn more philosophy. And so I was not expecting to go to college and learn any philosophy. But I ended up signing up for a class on personal identity just because I was interested still. And I thought maybe I would dabble. But I thought I was going to go do poli sci and econ. But then as soon as I took that first philosophy class, I was like, okay, this is the program for me. And so I ended up signing up for maybe 15 more of my course there.
Wow. Well, and it's interesting. I took several, I think I was one course short of a philosophy minor at college. And it was, I was just really blessed with a wonderful man, Tom Williams, who was one of those, philosophers that would never allow you to be comfortable with the stance you had currently chosen, so, and which is, I think, I wish everyone would take, you know, classes with people like that, because we all get so, you know, embedded or, you know, entrenched in our biases. And it's, you know, there should always be a bit of childlike wonderment that goes, well, what if, you know, or how does that? So if nothing else, I think that honestly is a testimony to free will, that we keep on asking those questions. So whether or not I can prove it exists, I don't know. I'm just going to choose to believe that's what it is. So, yeah. Right.
Now that's my position too. And I think you're right that, that this idea of the open-endedness, of our exploration actually may have something to say about free will. When you think of laws, physical laws, as restrictive of our actions, which is kind of the classic way of trying to argue against free will, it actually doesn't seem quite right, given that we exist in this combinatorial space where there's all these options, and it's not the low level self is not obligated to settle into any one arrangement. It can actually find itself supporting many different arrangements. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we're sort of navigating the space and choosing, you know, which way to go based on intuition about, you know, which kind of combinations are going to be best for us. It starts to undermine this idea of physical laws as restrictive. It almost looks like the physical laws are a kind of resource that we draw on. Mm-hmm. We can almost combine the components into any arrangement that suits us. Mm-hmm. In this very way. So, you know, in evolution is a kind of testament to this as well. From cell to multicellularity to cultures and economies and technology.
Right. I like to think of them almost as guardrails. You know, there's plenty of road beyond the guardrail. It's a point to help you decide a path that's at least, a common path that you'd be reasonably sure it's going to get to a destination that's prescribed, right? So, but I've never liked guardrails. I always want to get off the trail and kind of see what's over behind that hill. So, and people are like, you can't take a car there. Well, yeah, you can. It might not be good for the car, but I'm going. So you get done with, you start in college. And at what point in college did you come up with the idea of Quevos?
That was actually, I don't have an exact date, but that was either at the end of middle school or early high school.
Oh, okay.
That had an idea that egg whites could make chips. Okay. Because, you know, I saw those like crispy, flaky bits of egg white on the pan, and they crunched, and I thought this would be a low carb snack for me. But I never really acted on it other than maybe, you know, doing a little playing around in the kitchen and then moving on.
Sure.
And then at the end of high school, actually the summer going into college, I called Nick up, my best friend growing up, who I met in third grade. And I was like, hey, you know, I'm playing around with these egg chips. I think I called them at that point. And I said, you want to come hang out and do a little experimentation with me? And so we played around maybe for a few days or a few weeks that summer. We got like a cheap air fryer and also got a dehydrator for like fruits and jerkies. Okay. And try to see if that would be a way to get the egg whites to, you know, form like a chip.
Sure.
And we made it almost nowhere and kind of put that aside. And then Nick actually revisited the idea his sophomore year of college. He went to UChicago, and they've got a great ecosystem for supporting startups there, including this undergraduate incubator. And so he applied to that, really developed the first stage of the business, and actually won that competition. And we got a check, and that was pretty inspiring and emboldening us to take some time off of school and work on the project.
Okay. And I think one place I read that you at that point, you must have talked with your parents, both of you, and said, we want to take some time off school. And they were agreeable with that. And I got to believe, I mean, if you were my kids, I'd be going, oh, my God, yeah, sure. I mean, go out in the real world, find out what it's like. A business, that's a great way to learn something, right? So, and you ended up going back to school even. So it wasn't like, I'm just going to do this now. He experiments. He actually came up with the process. Then is that fair to say?
Not quite. We played around with a lot of different processes, and it turned out there were actually multiple processes that each had their defects, but maybe they would be workable if we pursued them. And one was the most sort of like straightforward for us to move forward with, for each of these processes, they were proprietary, and so we couldn't what wouldn't be easy just to go to a regular contract manufacturer and say, hey, make this for us. Okay. So we did have to do a lot of, figuring on our own. I think those first 6 months he was playing around with a handful of the processes that we,
were most promising.
And we ended up settling on one of those, after some further experimentation.
Okay. And then you ended up doing some crowdsourcing. Was that right? Or crowdfunding?
Yeah. We did a Kickstarter campaign. That was about 6 months into our operations. So okay. we had set up a facility. It was actually in a commercial kitchen space that we were leasing part of. We'd probably done, somewhere like four to six months of sales, on our very first product, but we knew it had a long way to go until it was ready for mass market. Okay. So we sold through like our first, I guess, something like 30,000 bags of the product.
30,000 bags kind of out of the gates, right? So
yeah. Over the course of that,
how do you even produce 30,000 bags? Though I mean, what kind of workforce does it take to produce that?
Yeah, we'd hired two manufacturing employees to basically churn those out over the course of like 6 months. So it was not a very efficient process at that time.
Okay.
I was in there sometimes working on the product alongside them, sometimes doing labor alongside them. Usually the way it would work is I would be doing experimentation. And so I would have my own little area, and I would throw a rack in to test something out alongside the rest of the product. Okay. And then eventually we actually graduated to having the experiments, be part of we would take some of the batter and do it like this and then some like that. And those were usually when we were closer to the mark and we just needed to test small differences, where the product would be good enough in either case. It was a lot of just figuring out, how to improve and how to get more efficient and that sort of thing.
For some reason, I have this image of Dexter's laboratory, and you guys are, the assembly line's going and you guys are in the corner going, trying to put a little bit of this in that oil of newt, and you just kind of, oil of newt doesn't poof. That didn't work well. So, that'd be kind of fun. So, but you had to also do all the product development in terms of the packaging and the logo. Is that something you guys were doing as well? Or did you have friends that copped in?
Yeah, for our initial logo, we worked with, on a platform called 99 Designs, okay. where there was that we sponsored between yep. designers. And so, you put in your kind of criteria, we want something minimal and clean. It needs to communicate the core proposition of the product, which is that it's made from egg whites and high in protein.
Right.
And that was, it worked out really well. We had a logo that we actually stuck with through our appearance at Shark Tank. So we took it, must've been 3 years or 2 years of, using that as our logo.
Okay.
And, then we've done sort of one more major packaging revision since then. So the initial logo was basically just the outline of an egg. And that was the whole thing. So minimal and clean. And then in the middle, we had where the yolk would be, we had some nutrition facts, basically.
Okay.
now the packaging still has that kind of egg as the background now. It's not so much foreground like it used to be. We've sort of kept – in touch with our roots, but we've evolved. Now it's a little more sophisticated and a lot more detail in the package now.
Well, and the bags too. I mean, all of that has to be sourced, right? The what's the bag going to be made of? How is it sealed up after the product's put into it? I mean, we're talking assembly line, right? When you're looking at 70,000 bags, is that what you said that first year?
Yeah. Initially, I think 30,000 that we sold out.
Okay.
And then for our Kickstarter campaign, I think something 40,000 bags were ordered for that.
Okay.
And then after that, we sort of then simultaneously developed our website, Quibus.com, and then our Amazon channel. And the Amazon channel ended up being where we did most of our business for the next year and a half or so,
okay.
as we're getting more retailers.
Okay.
So now our retail business is pretty solid as well. We're in, I think, about 3,000 stores across the country.
Okay. Was there ever a point in that? I mean, in those early times, I worked with a gentleman years ago with a company called Winter Silks. And this was a younger guy. He was, in, I think, in his 20s, maybe early 30s, when he and his wife decided to, you know, do a mail order catalog back in the days when DM was just getting started. And he was a skier, had, you know, been an editor for Ski Magazine, but had this idea. And he and his wife started up the company in the, you know, third floor of their house and, you know, sent out these, you know, different flyers, catalogs to people, and found that silks were the only thing that sold. So he started, you know, focusing on that, silk long johns, silk glove liners. And I remember asking Frank Farrell was his name, and asking him, you know, was there a point when you just went, oh my God, what am I doing here? You know, that this is, because it, I got to believe there's a point where you just kind of go, the magnanimity of it is kind of overwhelming. And you either, like you did with diabetes, either push through it or you go, oh, no, no, I didn't think it was going to be like this. Was there, or did you find that at all? Or were you just, you're so consumed with your passion for what you're doing that it just never got on the table?
I think two things here. Sorry, there's my dogs.
Oh, that's okay. They probably want to contribute to the conversation. I'm sure they have something important to say. So
yeah, I think there's two things that really helped kind of keep us moving forward. One was that people thought the idea was like so timely and interesting that we just kind of had like encouragement, like just continue to come in from like, you know, from all sorts of places. Like people wanted to do PR about this. And retailers were interested, and even though we didn't have that much traction, it was still something they would consider. So I think it was really fortunate timing and a great idea to run with.
Okay.
And also Nick really was, I don't think I was at a point in my life where I would have done this myself. But Nick was really interested in scaling this up. And so he really got the ball rolling his sophomore year. Okay. And then it was like I was almost stepping into an operation that already had momentum. So okay. that helped a lot.
Okay.
You know, despite all that, I still craved the academic stimulus that, you know, that I had those first 2 years of college, because I actually took a gap year between sophomore and junior year to work on the project. And so by the end of the year, I was really proud of what we'd done with the product and the initial traction we'd gotten and the funds we'd raised and everything. But I sort of, you know, thought that I would be best served going back to school and kind of watching from the sidelines and staying a member of the board and talking with Nick often. But that ended up my decision. And, you know, in the 4 years since making that decision, Nick has been full time on the project and has continued the day to day operations.
Okay.
So he's had that sort of stick-to-itiveness that, you know, people really admire in entrepreneurs. I think I've cultivated more of that since then. Okay. So, you know, now I'm day-to-day on LifeStacks, and I have been for a year and a half. And, you know, I think there's almost nothing that can happen today that would make me question whether we should move forward.
Sure.
But it took some time for me to get there.
Yeah, it takes stick-to-itiveness, right, as you talk to. So you got to a point then where you ended up being on Shark Tank. And just so people are, if you haven't caught wind of this, we've been sort of talking around, but Quavos was a startup company devoted to a healthy snack, basically for people with diabetes or that were just looking for things with low carb, high protein, and yet were snacky. You know, I mean, everyone, where's the snacks? What did you bring enough snacks? I have to have snacks. What's going on here? Where are the snacks? We our life's center around snacks, it seems, in America. So Quavos is an answer to that, a healthy alternative, right? And you wanted to take it the next step. You went to Shark Tank and presented in chicken suits, which I thought was, you know, like full-fledged chicken suits. And then I saw a paper picture. It actually was your tops normal. And then this, you were riding a chicken, essentially, was the way it was set up. So if people don't look closely, I think it was inhumane treatment of chickens, but it's just a costume. Okay. So mellow out. anyways, so how did that come about?
Yeah, well, in terms of the whole Shark Tank experience or the chicken suit?
No, both. All. Yeah, I mean, at some point, was it Nick that said, you know, hey, let's put chicken suits on? Yeah, that's a great idea. So, and you're young enough to think, yeah, that would be fun. Why not?
Yeah, I think that probably was Nick's idea. With Shark Tank, you've got a production team that you work with ahead of time, because it's so, you know, there's so many different parts to, you know, the appearance on Shark Tank and so many things to know in advance that they don't just like, they don't just thrust you into the tank and say best of luck.
Right.
They really are, they do have your back. They want, you know, for them, it's about making sure that you present well so that it actually makes good TV. They don't just want, you know, people that have no idea what's going on there, embarrassing themselves, wasting everybody's time.
Right.
They really want to be, you know, a valuable experience for the audience. So that involves basically the whole setup, your display. You know, they sort of coach you on what makes sense to show and the sort of art around that. And there's an art team that works on that with you.
Okay.
And then also the upfront pitch, you know, that's up to you to write, but they give a sense of like, you know, what kinds of things make for a compelling pitch to sharks.
Okay.
And one of them is humor. So, you know, if you can really make them laugh off the bat, then there's a lightness in the room that serves you.
Sure.
So I think that, you know, our pitch was supposed to be humorous, and then also the choice of chicken costumes to really soften them up right off the bat. And then actually I do think it was Nick that proposed this. And as soon as the idea was sort of like floated, we were like, okay, this is crazy.
Right.
But maybe it's exactly what we should do.
Yeah.
We chose to wear the chicken costumes. And then I think I was the one who suggested that we should jog in instead of the typical walk through the corridor. So there's these two fools just running in on chickens. And the sharks cracked up with that immediately.
Well, you know, it's all I don't know if you've ever seen Singing in the Rain, but Donald O'Connor has it's a 1950s musical, really wonderful. You have to, you know, suspend reality for a while. But Donald O'Connor, who is a wonderful comedian, singer, dancer, vocalist, actor, does a song to make them laugh. No matter what you do, make them laugh. So, and there's a lot of truth and power to that. So you ended up being on the show too. Did you know that Zelensky was going to, not Zelensky, the gentleman with Kind products, that he was going to be there? Was that known ahead of time?
Yes. We did know he was there. You know, I think in, as they, there's a lot of days that they film.
Okay.
So
Lebetsky,
they probably 20 days or so of filming, over the course of like their season.
Okay.
And so they try to make good pairings between who was coming on and then the expertise of the sharks.
Okay, good. So you actually are, the cards are weighted to some extent in your favor, or stacked in your favor. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So we were really thrilled to have him on the panel. And then we went in hoping that he would be the shark that we would make a deal with.
Okay.
So we would have been happy with any of the sharks. And, you know, even happy to have a good showing if we didn't make a deal, but we at least did a respectable job and got some interest, and maybe the terms just didn't work out exactly, we would have been okay with that.
Okay.
But that was definitely the one we had in mind.
Sure. So he ends up buying into the show. What was it? A $200,000 initial investment, and he got a percentage of the company as a result of that. Is that right?
That's right. So we went out there asking for $200K for 5%, I think. And we ended up negotiating $200K plus a line of credit for 10%.
Okay. Okay. So you got double the money you were asking for, essentially, and he got double the percentage that you were planning on. Okay. So it's actually, you kind of cut even, right? Ultimately.
Yeah.
And now his intent was to take you globally right away, isn't it? I mean, he's really pushing this to be he sees this a national market here that is, you know, seems like the sky's the limit almost, right?
Yeah. For sure. Yeah. The goal is to grow smart, and grow fast.
Okay.
So, you know, of course it's better to, you know, not run out of cash and, you know, make sure things are running efficiently and that you're in a position to scale up.
Right.
But then as soon as you get those good signals, then you can sort of grow from there.
Sure.
So he's been interested in both these aspects, like making sure that the business is fundamentally sound, and then also making sure that we grow as quickly as possible, you know, given that we want to stay healthy and, you know, operating well.
Sure. Sure.
So yeah, both those pieces. I think often the emphasis is more on the side of like, make sure to do the right channels in the right order. You don't just take whatever comes your way. You take the things that are going to actually make your business healthier and larger. and healthier and larger, that's a hard balance to strike because, you know, you end up compromising your margin, you end up needing to pay a lot in marketing just to keep the chips moving through the store. Right. So it's always a balancing act, and he's been, you know, helpful in helping us understand how that looks.
Yeah. It's always interesting to me because there's an arts and a science component to any of this stuff, right? And the art is the what feels right, and you know, designing the product, you know, being in tune with what's going on in the whole, you know, gestalt of this thing, as it takes its own wings and flies. And then there's the science, though, of the logistics, all of the things that have to be, you know, attended to, those details that aren't necessarily fun, but they make it possible to fly, right? So. So is any point along there where, I think in my own background in theater and acting and, you know, the performing arts in general, one of the things that kills people, I think, is the ego. You know, we get so full of ourselves and so, you know, wow, I really am something, you know, the Ron Burgundy thing, you know, you think back, well, yeah, was that the beginning of the end? I don't say that for any other reason. Is what you're not there. I sense it in you the real sense of not being full of yourself at all. I mean, this is a significant accomplishment to have it. What, you're 23, 24? Is that right? So
yeah, 20.
Okay. How are you keeping yourself balanced in terms of just level headed?
Yeah, honestly, I've humbled out over the years because it's become more clear to me that when I thought I knew everything, I was totally wrong. So I think that helped. You know, I think if you were talking to me when I was 17, it would be a different story.
You were obnoxious then. Is that what you're saying? So
yeah, arrogant probably. Yeah. But I hope I've got less of that now. I think with the business, it was never too hard to be somewhat humble about that because for as much traction as we were getting, excitement that there was around it, we just knew that, we weren't yet at the finish line. And we still know that. So I think there's a lot of enthusiasm and encouragement and some disbelief, like, you know, that we had managed to get it to where it was. And for me that, I definitely appreciated that sort of respect, but I knew sort of behind the scenes, it's like, actually this has been a long journey and it's been difficult. And, I benefited a lot from, all these external forces that have made it possible. There's no sense that I was somehow making everything happen or anything like that.
Well, you're not taking it for granted, right? I mean, we're all the product of so much behind us, you know, and that maybe that's where the ego really comes into play, is to think that, you know, I am the center of universe, and forgetting the fact that, no, I'm just part of a larger team, and we're accomplishing something really wonderful together. So let's talk about that. So you have this product, Huevos, which is, you know, stellar product. I have to get on Amazon. I confess I wanted to beforehand get on Amazon, order myself some, you know, Huevos Rancheros sounded really good. And the barbecue, of course, I'm a big barbecue guy. So I apologize, Zach. I didn't get that done before we talked, but if we talk again, I guarantee you, I will do it before then. So have you found that I look at some of the core things that you can talk about, and one of them is wise living. Have you found that I would think Huevos has inspired and reaffirmed how important that is and how choices we make inform that and can encourage that? How are you finding that this is helping you to have a wiser life?
Yeah, that's for sure. I think definitely Huevos are a great choice for me, people like me, people doing keto, people that are just looking for something to crunch on that isn't just chock full of carbs. And also I should say, with the fiber and the protein are also, you know, a really great aspect of the chips that most snacks don't have. I think fiber, is pretty much the nutrient that we are all the most efficient in. The gut microbiome feeds on fiber. It actually creates these metabolites called short chain fatty acids as a result of eating that fiber. So we're really not feeding ourselves. We're feeding our microbiome, and then those metabolites end up feeding us. Most people are not getting nearly enough fiber. It's the recommended allowance is 25 grams, and pretty much nothing has it, because as you're processing carbs in today's sort of industrial food setting, you basically take the fibrous aspect and just throw that part out. So, because the carb itself, the starch, ends up being the better part to work with in an industrial setting, and it's also less filling. So you end up having more of the snacks that have less fiber. We want you to have a certain amount of huevos and then feel satiated, feel full. We don't want you to have to eat like 10 bags of this stuff to feel like you got your fill. That's counterproductive. We want a snack that actually works in your life.
I always think of fiber as being something too, like shredded wheat, but that's not the case at all, is it? So.
Yeah. So shredded wheat, fill me in.
A cereal, kind of like, think of mini wheats. Shredded wheat was a big honk and, one of those biscuits. You ate it with milk and, it was, when I was a kid, we poured a ton of sugar on it because that made it palatable, but it's really very, not very processed wheat, that was crunchy, toasted. Right. So, yeah. Anyway, right. I tend to think of grains as being, things that have a lot of fiber in them, but I can't imagine that eggs, which are one of the major components of huevos, how does that have fiber in it?
Eggs actually don't. So you're thinking of the right kind of thing. It's mostly grains and starches in the processed forms.
Okay.
Fruits and vegetables as well that are very dense in fiber. Things like eggs and meat don't have fiber in them.
Okay.
So it's really the egg white. The egg white's the sort of main ingredient. It's providing the protein, and it's providing a lot of that crunch also. But then there's other ingredients that we need to include to basically give the chip shape and form, okay, and to also make the grittiness that's natural for proteins smooth.
Okay.
Because we want to make sure it's palatable and delicious.
Delicious helps a lot. So.
Right.
But
so supporting carb ingredients, and we made sure that those ingredients have their own sort of health properties.
Okay.
We don't want to use anything artificial or anything that would compromise the health benefits that you're getting from the product. So that includes certain fibers that are like fructooligosaccharides, including what we're using now, which is called inulin. And inulin is a really good fiber source that also has a light sweetness to it. So it really serves well. It goes well in snack foods.
Okay. The sweet and salty is always good too. So are there, when I think of Wise Living too, you actually talk about it being making daily consumption choices. I'm very guilty, and I didn't really start to think about it until I made a conscious effort to lose a lot of weight. But, we make choices based on expediency a lot of the time. I don't have time to think about, or I don't have time to prepare or whatever, a meal. I'm just going to, go grab a burger from such and such. And that isn't wise. Can you talk a little bit about the process of getting disciplined to make better choices for food, what that looks like?
Sure. Yeah. So I think the philosophical background actually is pretty informative for me in thinking about our daily choices. Here's sort of how I think about it. Our life is made up of outcomes. And those outcomes are basically states of our body and our mind and the relationship of that to the world. And it's, all we have is those basically strung together in this sort of sequential, 100-year-long kind of format.
Yeah.
So what actually produces those outcomes, as I said, it's states. States are basically the flow of energy through structure. We got this body, there's like stuff coming in, and that just contributes to the way in which these outcomes are generated, basically. I think of in terms of mind, body, and environment, and a kind of relationship across those things. Any individual consumption choice is sort of a micro allocation of this total budget of all the things that we can consume and do. And the goal for any individual micro choice would be for it to contribute positively to the rest of the ecosystem. So I enjoy it as I'm having it. It makes me feel better today, and it also supports my longevity and performance over the long run. That would be the goal of a given food. And you know, since we, it's not like I could say, you know, hey, here's my life package, have this, never make a choice again. There isn't something like that at this point. And so we have to sort of, do a makeshift version of that where we're just stringing a bunch of different things together. You know, I eat this, then that, and then I sleep at this time and I wake up and I do these activities. And it's all sort of this like bottom up makeshift, fairly unstructured kind of thing that we're pulling together. So, you know, at this point, entrepreneurially, I think of these individual items that are kind of like interventions that hopefully have these positive spillover effects into the rest of your day and the rest of your life. I guess as I think about the future of consumption, I actually hope it's more holistic. So I hope that we're actually thinking, you know, broadly about the way that all these different things are interacting and then generating outcomes. Because, you know, it's not like we can separate, the way I feel today from the way that impacts the rest of my week or rest of my month or even my whole life.
Right.
So, but you know, at this point, I think the best we have is to string together a bunch of experiences that each individually support our well-being and then hopefully do so collectively as well.
Well, it strikes me as you're talking that there's a need to be accountable for the choices that we do make, right? Because it's another kind of an example of free will is, you know, I can give you all the information and you can research and find all of the possibilities that there are within the scope of experience. But at the end of the day, it's your responsibility to choose. And, you know, if you make informed decisions about what you choose, you know, take responsibility for those, be accountable for those. And, you know, we all talk, oh, yeah, I'm going to lose weight next year. Well, you know, that's an admirable goal, but you're making a whole bunch of choices each and every day, each and every hour that are either going to help you towards that goal or not. So let's evaluate whether or not you really want to do that or not. So it's like me, that's part of what you're leading to is make sure you understand what your choice really is. You know, make sure you, you know, if you're wanting to do a healthier lifestyle, that's going to be some hard work. It's not just a, okay, I have a healthy lifestyle now. I bought that at Kmart. Oops. So Kmart doesn't exist anymore, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I mean, my hope long run is that it becomes that the science continues to develop as to what kinds of interventions are going to be, easiest for people to do and to get towards their health, goals. Because you know, our willpower is finite and, the more difficult something is to stick with it, the less likely we are to stick with it. But you know, for now, we all have to, you know, make our way through this landscape of consumption decisions alone, and so that does require some discipline. But you know, fortunately, I think there are some of these interventions that are fairly easy to do actually reshape our orientation around food. Mm-hmm. So I found fasting to be a great intervention for me. Because it's actually taught me to want food less. And so now I'm making more of my choices from this place of, you know, what is going to make me feel good and what's going to nourish me instead of like, what do I crave? I found fasting actually is kind of like, created the space between me and what I might crave. Right. You know, I used to be a fiend for sugar. And now I'll have a bite of something without needing to have like 100 bites of that thing. But no, it's not. I'm not saying that all of a sudden I have this extra reservoir of willpower that I'm tapping into, or I'm being more disciplined because I'm working harder at it. Of course, there has been hard work to like adopt the lifestyle, and but I think we should be looking for things that actually make it easier, mm-hmm. not harder, for us mm-hmm. to stick with our goals. And so, I guess there's one other thing I wanted to add here, which is. Yes, I mean, definitely accountability. And there's a clear reason for that. These things are synergistic and additive in a sense. I basically think of all of our consumption decisions as contributing to a loop. So basically, you know, I think of a human as a kind of self-sorting machine in the sense that we supply something and then we are the consumer of what it is that we supplied. So let's go mind, body, and environment. So in the mind, this is the easiest to see. You think something, And that thing that you think is now the mental state that you're in as you go to think something else. And so as you're going off and thinking, so you're on a walk, you're conducting this loop of you're doing this kind of internal action, which is thought, and then you're the recipient of that action. And then you act from there again. And let's say you're Einstein. I think we spoke about him in our last session. That thought loop, if you conduct that well, ends up being the engine for discovery. So you are supplying this insight, and hopefully it's meeting the sort of curiosity that you demand to be met. So he's curious about what the fundamental nature of things is, and so he supplies all this thinking, all this orientation towards answering that question. And then ultimately, at some point, he registers, okay, my demand has been met. I understand how some process actually works, or at least I have a theory for that. And now it's a matter of testing that theory. I think, our thoughts are this self-serving loop. Same thing with our bodies. Basically the my physiology today lets me do a certain set of things that then feed back onto my physiology and give me a foundation for tomorrow. So with exercise, for example, it's like the actions I'm doing actually unlock new actions for me to do tomorrow, effectively. And same with what we're eating, of course, you eat sugar, and then all of a sudden you crave more sugar, right. Or somehow you're able to make a break from that. So it's like what you're doing right now actually feeds into what you're inclined to do tomorrow, what you're able to do tomorrow. And then the last piece is the world. So, now this reciprocal relationship is no longer self-serving. It's actually more, participatory. So you do something in the world goes and processes that action and then gives you back a result. And so you can think of your social behavior as very much like this. It's like, I'll say something and then you hear it, you respond to it, and then I get a result based on what I said. And then same thing with economic participation. You do a certain set of things as your input to the production process, mm-hmm. and you get a certain set of things back, like a bunch of products and some payments.
Right.
Sorry, I'm going crazy. So I'll see the floor.
You know, that's okay. They have comments too. And this is probably affecting, they've got, points of view that need to be considered in this whole thing. Folks, my guest is Zach Schreier. We're going to take a break and he and I aren't going to go anywhere, but you're going to have to wait another week to hear about one other topic that I want to kind of carry on. We've touched on a little bit here is fasting protocols. And the last thing about that is rethinking healthy. So we'll come back and try to hit those things in the last session of this three-part interview with Zach Schreier, one of the co-founders of Huevos, which is a great product if you're looking for a great snack. And I'm not making anything for saying that. I'm just knowing Zach, it's got to be wonderful. And, with a partner like Nick Hamburger and all the things he's talked about him, it can't help but be a quality thing. So don't go anywhere here. Zach, you don't go anywhere. I won't go anywhere. But folks, we hope you join us next week for the last part of this interview with Zach Schreier. Thanks, Zach. Be right back.